This week on Your Western Context, the Alberta NDP engages in identity politics. The Trudeau government gives $12 million to Loblaws to save the environment, and Trudeau believes there are consequences for lying to Canadians. Also, the media blows up a story on the Winnipeg Jets street parties. This is Western Context, episode 114, recorded Saturday, April 13th, 2019, identifying mudslinging. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are sitting in once again, as we do each and every week. Welcome back as well to our listeners, new and regular.
That's for sure. Welcome back, and it's good to have you if this is the first time joining us, and if you've been with us from the beginning, welcome back as well. We've got lots to talk about this week, lots that's going on in the news, of course, and some follow-ups to some stories that we've been following for a little bit, and definitely some new ones that caught us out of left field almost, but of course, lots to talk about that the media hasn't been.
Indeed, and you know, if you're joining us for the first time, if you're one of these new listeners and you know, you're wondering what this is all about, well, we've been doing this for about 2 years now, give or take, and what we're here to do is provide all the information and context necessary to put yourself on the right side of the news, showing what the media is not covering, what they should be covering, and you know, just sometimes the absurd stories that do manage to creep up, and we do have many of those this week. So we're going to start this week in Alberta, and the last week of the Alberta election campaign was largely quiet this week until about Thursday, which is really surprising for a campaign of this magnitude and the amount of focus it has received throughout the rest of the country. One would have thought we would have had more news stories to talk about, but there really wasn't anything new this week until Thursday. And what we're going to talk about with that is Edmonton Southwest candidate for the NDP, John Archer. Now, you might not have heard of him before. You might be thinking of Captain Jonathan Archer from Star Trek Enterprise, but this John Archer is a former CBC journalist and actually the former press secretary to Alberta Transport Minister Brian Mason. So why is he in the news, you might wonder, and why is this such a big deal? Well, on Wednesday, he posted a tweet with the following words. It basically said, "Vote as if your skin is not white. Your son is transgender. Your mom needs cancer treatment. Your house was flooded. Your overtime pay feeds your family. Your daughter's class is bursting at the seams. Your sister quit her job because she can't afford childcare. Or your hometown was destroyed by a wildfire. Vote as if your family depends on it." And, you know, this is ultimately making the horrible and short-sighted assumption that each of these voting blocs will vote in unison, and they feel, the NDP feels, that the vote of the folks who aren't white, people who might be transgendered, or the ones who are undergoing cancer treatment, or the Calgary flood victims, all are assuming in this case that the NDP wants those votes, and this tweet effectively signals that this vote should belong to the NDP out of everybody in this group. Now, Archer ultimately deleted this post, saying it was not in line with the message I want to share during this campaign, and it was a mistake, and I apologize. Now, this would be a story if it happened in any of the 87 provincial ridings in Alberta, but it's actually more interesting because there's a huge irony around this, and that's because Archer's running against Casey Madu of the United Conservative Party, who is an immigrant from Nigeria who came to Canada with his wife in 2005. Now, Madu had this to say as a comment: "As an African, I am deeply offended by Mr. Archer's derogatory comment about skin color, which is designed solely to divide and offend." Now, this story was also pointed out by the Postmillennial, which is an online publication, and they did some analysis on this, and it ultimately infers that the tweet in question is saying that the UCP doesn't care about transgendered people, it doesn't care about those battling cancer and needing the healthcare system, it doesn't care about people who've had floods damage their property or houses, it doesn't care about families who live paycheck to paycheck, it doesn't care about educational standards, or it doesn't care about those unable to provide childcare for their families. Now, the tweet, of course, gained little attention by the conventional media, but as we know from, you know, what we've seen over the past 4 weeks, is that remarks from years past, both in paper publications and online, by UCP candidates for things that have ultimately amounted to less than this in some cases, have gained more than a day or two of media coverage on this. And, you know, this is something that when the election started, we made it a commitment to talk about these kind of things, the unfair media coverage that comes up, because our first election covering on this podcast was the BC election, and one of the hallmark moments in that case was the I Am Linda scandal, which the media didn't give the full attention to and could very well have swayed that election. And we want to make sure that all the information regarding anything that comes out about events like these is delivered to you guys, the listeners. Now, we also have to ask the question, why is it that the NDP's mudslinging always seems to get covered in the media? And when it's in terms of something that an NDP candidate did bad, that is, for all intents and purposes, in most cases, ignored. Well, this week there was also a publisher's note in the Weekly Anchor, which you might not have heard of, but it's a small paper. It covers the town of Edson, west of Edmonton, and Yellowhead County, and they highlighted a concerning email that the paper received. Now, the paper claims to have received an email from Maureen Mariupoli, who has an albertandp.ca email address. Now, the email said, "Hey there, you didn't get this from me, but I thought you might want to follow up on this." And they didn't include what was in the email, but it was inferred that the following message in the email was mudslinging towards a local candidate, and in this case, probably not the NDP candidate. The email also says, "You didn't get this from me," which tells us that the sender wanted to remain anonymous, but that's pretty hard to do if you're sending the email from an albertandp.ca email address. And, you know, doing what good journalists do, the Weekly Anchor investigated this further and found out that Maureen Mariupoli is the communications officer for the Alberta NDP caucus, of all things. So what this means is that whenever the Alberta NDP caucus, when the legislature was sitting, wanted to send out a message release, this person would be in charge of sending that out to the various media outlets and phrasing the message in a way that would ultimately garner more attention. Now, Rachel Notley has been asked before in this campaign if anyone inside the NDP is sending mudslinging stories to the media, and she has flat out denied this. But we have the evidence right here that this email says the exact opposite. And the Weekly Anchor ultimately ended their coverage on this with a really good question. And they said, "Are those involved in the NDP political trenches of this election so emboldened by the ease of posting mudslinging and misinformation on social media that they now feel comfortable attempting to pass off emails like this to newspapers?" And when you look at that sentence and you look at that question, that's a pretty big deal, because, you know, if you look at social media for this campaign, at least the first half of it, or maybe two-thirds of it, seemed to be dominated by the pro-NDP forces online. And, you know, we would see various things crop up that might not, or in some cases didn't indeed turn out to be true regarding UCP candidates and Alberta Party candidates. But since then, there is a general sense from what I've seen and what we've been watching online that if you look at any of the tweets or posts made by NDP sources, the tune has seemed to have turned by them online as well. So what I think we're seeing here is ultimately a moving of the online social media harassment campaign, where it's easy to defame someone or post in what is effectively amounting to fake news and have it gain traction online. And then, you know, if a media company is out there and they're interested in raising their own profile by garnering more likes or clicks on the story, they will ultimately write a story about that and share it out far and wide. But here we see that the Weekly Anchor is ultimately doing what every one of these companies should do that posted these stories that originated on social media. They should actually be going deeper into where the source of this came from. And the very fact that the Weekly Anchor received a story from an Alberta NDP email address in the campaign speaks volumes about the way the NDP is conducting this campaign going forward.
Yeah, exactly. I think this whole story just highlights the dangers of social media and how if you're not engaging in critical thinking when you're reading something on social media, you could easily be misled by false news items or by someone who has an agenda, a particular agenda to either smear an opposite candidate or to try and change the narrative of what the media wants to talk about. And we see this all the time in different news stories where the mainstream media will just follow along with a story that was covered by a smaller piece, and then suddenly it blows up and no one actually looks at it to see if it's actually true or not, or to find out where the source actually came from or what even is going on in the story. And it's we see this all the time, and it's amazing that the Alberta NDP is actually trying to overtly push these stories out to these small publishers to try and smear the UCP on these issues when they're doing their own job on the NDP's Twitter by posting all these memes that are meant to divide people and try and push further the identity politic agenda that they're trying to do.
Yeah, and one of the things that has led to the great polarization that we see in the United States right now is the rise of identity politics, both on the left with the Hillary Clinton campaign and on the right in 2016 with the Donald Trump campaign. And this is the exact same page that the NDP has pulled here to try and turn the channel on the record that they're running on, and instead has made this very personal. And there are many stories throughout this campaign that we have looked at and have had questions about, and what we're actually considering doing after this whole thing is said and done is going through these and seeing if we can find any other linkage that might have come from the NDP now that we know that this has happened in this case, and that would certainly be an interesting exercise going forward in that. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think one last thing we should mention before we move on to our next story is talking a bit about the election itself and the fact that it is just happening on Tuesday this upcoming week on the 16th. So if you are in Alberta, you should go out and vote because your vote does count. And we want to make sure that the government that we're going to have after the election is going to be listening to you. So if you're in Alberta, make sure you go out and vote.
Indeed. What do we got next?
All right. So we're going to move on to our Canada story. And as we've seen lately in the news, the Trudeau government just can't help making headlines for all the wrong reasons lately. Now, there was a federal government announcement that happened just a few days ago that said that it will give as much as $12 million to help Loblaw Companies Limited to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. And this announcement, of course, is creating quite the backlash online. Now, the announcement sparked an uproar on social media, with commenters expressing frustration about Ottawa handing out money to a large profitable corporation. Opposition politicians also took to the internet to call out the federal Liberals for their subsidy. Now, a bit about the announcement, the federal government announced on Monday that it will provide up to $12 million to help the grocery chain convert refrigeration systems in about 370 stores. The money will come from the government's Low Carbon Economy Fund and is expected to help the company cut its carbon footprint by about 23%. Now, a bit about Loblaws, if you haven't heard about them. They've reported a profit of $754 million attributable to common shareholders in 2018, and the corporation is backed by some of Canada's wealthiest people. The company's largest shareholder is Galen Weston, who has an estimated net worth of $7.4 billion US. Now, the company, which owns stores such as Loblaws, Superstore, Fortinos, and Shoppers Drug Mart, is Canada's biggest grocery retailer, with $46.6 billion in revenue for 2018 alone, and it has a 63% market share of groceries in Canada. Now, Environment Minister Catherine McKenna doubled down on the announcement and attempted to defend her government's decision to hand out this $12 million in taxpayer money to the the billion-dollar corporation so it can install more energy-efficient fridges. Now, this comes just a year and a half after the company fought against raising the minimum wage, admitted to a 14-year bread price-fixing scheme, and ended up in a tax court battle last year that saw it ordered to pay back taxes worth roughly $368 million related to a banking subsidiary in the Caribbean. Now, McKenna, when asked why the company, which had a net earning of roughly $800 million last year, needed taxpayer money to retrofit its stores, she had this to say. She said, quote, "We have a climate plan that works with everyone. It works with large businesses, small businesses, cities, schools, hospitals, and municipalities." So she also said that Loblaws was one of the 50 winners through the competitive process. She said, why? Because they can get the most significant emission reductions. She said, the good news is we're supporting companies across the board, small companies, big companies, hospitals, schools, cities, and individuals to reduce their emissions. She compared the emissions reduction effect of retrofitting the fridges in the 370 stores as to taking 50,000 vehicles off the road every year. Now, independent grocers are also furious at this announcement, saying that it's akin to the government trying to help create monopolies. Amanda Stevenson, who is the owner of a Manitoba grocery store, said, quote, "It bothers me that people who have very little are paying taxes so Loblaws shareholders can have $12 million more in profit this year. Our dairy cooler just quit, but I'm not looking for a freebie." Jubilee Market, which is an independent grocer in Oakville, Ontario, posted on Twitter, quote, "We could use help upgrading our equipment, but we pay for our own when we can. Hashtag Loblaws give it back." Now, the $12 million is set to be used by Loblaw for retrofits scheduled to take place between 2019 and 2022, but it's not clear at this time whether the $12 million was given out in one chunk or whether it will be broken down as Loblaw hits retrofit targets, particularly given that 2019 is an election year that could potentially see the Liberals and their emissions reduction focus booted out of office. Now, Global News asked McKenna specifically whether the money will be given up front or if any of it is contingent on how much work the company actually does. However, she did not directly answer the question. She said, quote, "This project is, of course, contingent on them doing what they said they would do, which is a retrofit program across them for the money." Now, what is worse about this announcement is that it comes just 2 weeks after forcing the carbon tax on all Canadians, where Canadians of all incomes have to give up more of their hard-earned paycheck to the government under the guise of helping the environment, and now the Trudeau government is giving part of that money directly to one of the richest corporations in Canada. So I think that begs the question, how does that fit the narrative that Trudeau has spouted all along since the 2015 campaign that he's lowering taxes for the middle class and raising taxes for the wealthiest 1%.
You know, when we look at this story and look at the optics of this, it's almost as if that the government has blinders on and doesn't see the issue with this. Because, you know, $1 million is a lot of money. $12 million is a huge amount of money. And, you know, I would even go as so far as to say is that if this was in the tens of thousands of dollars, this would still be a problem for Canadians. Because when you look at what has happened over the last 2 weeks with the carbon tax, that is a tax that is just going to be paid by everyday Canadians. And here we are, we see a large company, Loblaw in this case, receiving what effectively amounts to a reward for lowering emissions when we know the company itself is owned by a billionaire. And, you know, when it comes down to a change election, we often look at the candidates themselves, the leader of the party in question, but there's also the side effect of who exactly that leader and that party associates themselves with, and you can see that right here. And I think if you asked any Canadian how they would feel about this, they would just shake their head and would find it an absolutely absurd story.
That's true, I think, and especially given the fact that Trudeau has been saying that he's working for lower income people, he's working for the middle class, he's, you know, raising taxes on the wealthiest 1% to show that they have their so that they will pay their fair share. And yet he turns around right before an election campaign and gives $12 million to one of the richest companies that's operating in Canada, one of the biggest monopolies that we have, and one of the companies that had made almost $1 billion of money last year. The fact that they gave them $12 million out of this when they could easily pay for these retrofits on their own, it's just absurd. And the fact that so many people in Canada these days are having trouble getting steady work, they're having trouble paying their taxes, and this just comes around, it's almost like a slap in the face. And I don't think that the Trudeau government realizes the damage that they're doing to themselves with stories like this.
Yeah, and you know, I think what we're seeing is we're seeing a shaping up in terms of the way the campaign is going to go this fall, and we can actually talk about that right now in our second Canada story. It has parallels to what's happening in Alberta, and it touches on the same veins as we saw in the Loblaw story. A government that's out of touch with what the people want and what the people feel. And you know, you can also look at the two members of parliament that were there at Loblaw's when they made that announcement, and they looked uncomfortable. And there's also a good deal of uncomfort this week in the media with this. And I think Justin Trudeau is trying to do something here that is going to set up the fall campaign, but let's dive into that right now. So shortly after our show was published last Sunday, word came out that Justin Trudeau is suing Andrew Scheer, leader of the opposition in the Conservative Party of Canada. Andrew Scheer received a letter from Trudeau's lawyer on March 31st, and you know, going from March 31st to April 7th, about a turnaround time of a week, that's a pretty short time in the legal world to respond to such a letter. So what exactly was in the letter? Well, the letter said that the statement that Andrew Scheer issued on March 29th contained highly defamatory comments about Prime Minister Trudeau. Now, in particular, Trudeau feels that he was defamed by Andrew Scheer on March 29th, where he said in public that the testimony given by Jody Wilson-Raybould was concrete evidence that proves Trudeau led a campaign to politically interfere with SNC-Lavalin's criminal prosecution. Now, Andrew Scheer reiterated the comments in the House of Commons this week, where he's protected by parliamentary privilege. And what that means is that anybody who is an MP or anybody who is in the House, when they speak, can say effectively whatever they want to. And if there would be a libel law or a slander law that would come into effect in the real world, that doesn't take effect in the House of Commons. Now, for good measure, though, Andrew Scheer also repeated these words outside the House of Commons this week as well, after he made it known that he received the letter from Justin Trudeau's lawyer. Now, this statement effectively says that he's calling Prime Minister Trudeau's bluff, and he's willing to see the matter taken to court if the Prime Minister really wants to do that. And keep in mind, if this goes to court, this will likely be happening around the time that the election happens this fall. Now, the Prime Minister's office said that Scheer was on notice that there are consequences for making completely false and libelous statements. And, you know, Trudeau's comments on the matter were as follows. I think it's important that all politicians be straight with Canadians in how they characterize their own actions and their own beliefs. I think we're going to have an election in the coming months. You can't be inventing things. You can't be lying to Canadians. And, you know, other people have said that this is an attempt to silence debate outside of the House, and that's exactly what Andrew Scheer's lawyer said. Now, the pathway forward for Trudeau is this. He can carry on with the lawsuit, use that lawsuit to say that Andrew Scheer lies and make things up. This Friday, he was at a rally in Toronto where he lumped Andrew Scheer in with Doug Ford and various people on the alt-right. And he will run an election campaign through a fear and smear campaign, as Rachel Notley and the NDP is doing right now here in Alberta. Whereas if you look at the pathway forward for Andrew Scheer, opinion polling says that the public vastly agrees with Jody Wilson-Raybould and believes her testimony. Andrew Scheer can also paint himself as the Conservative Party as one that is focused on exposing the truth of what happened with SNC-Lavalin. They can also provide clear policy alternatives to the Liberals, and in doing so, Andrew Scheer will ultimately be siding with the majority of Canadians. And by matching the public on how they feel with the SNC level and scandal, and that the majority of people believe Jody Wilson-Raybould over the prime minister, Andrew Scheer will have a much easier time winning people over. And this is because, ultimately, if you agree someone, they're more likely to follow you and follow what you suggest them to do. And this is a very basic tenet of communication, in that if you agree with someone, you're going to have an easier time getting the conversation started. And then when you get to the points of detail, you're going to be more likely to convince them that your path is the right way. Now, Andrew Scheer already had this method on trial this week. On Thursday, he campaigned with Jason Kenney in Calgary for a rally that was officially an Alberta provincial rally for the United Conservative Party, but this was also a ramp-up to the fall's election campaign. And if there's one constant that we're seeing throughout this week, it's that the fear and smear tactics used by Notley and the NDP, and now Justin Trudeau against Andrew Scheer, showcase the need for a united front across Canada. You could almost say that a united Conservative Party is needed to deal with the campaign style that is almost certain to come from Justin Trudeau this fall. And if the United Conservative Party is successful in Alberta, that will make Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Ontario all potentially on the same side of this SNC-Lavalin issue. And that's something that the Prime Minister probably doesn't want.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think just the audacity of Trudeau to say that there are consequences for lying to Canadians, when he was in denial from the very beginning of this SNC story that, no, this didn't happen. There was no pressure. It was all just made up, almost. And that he was saying that it never happened, and that the PMO never directed pressure onto Jody Wilson-Raybould. And now we're a couple months later, we found out exactly how much pressure the PMO put on them. And I think it's pretty clear. I think it's actually a fairly true statement. What Scheer said was that there was concrete evidence that proved that Justin Trudeau led a campaign to politically interfere with SNC-Lavalin's criminal prosecution. And I think that's something that was pretty clear throughout what all that's happened, that we've seen through all the different testimonies from Gerald Butts, from Michael Wernick, to Jody Wilson-Raybould herself. This is basically what the story has been leading up to. And the fact that he is going after Scheer for defamatory comments, when in fact they're most likely to be true, just shows that Trudeau's out of touch with what Canadians actually feel about, because there's been many polls that have been showing, sentiment polls that show that Jody Wilson-Raybould is believed by a clear majority of Canadians. And it's very clear that the Liberal government on this issue is very much on the wrong side of public opinion.
Yeah, and because of that, that's what we're going to see in the fall campaign. And, you know, this could have been an easy story to put away for Trudeau back in February. He could have said, yes, there was this meeting that happened. We did ask her to look into different options on that. That wasn't right. That pressure wasn't right. And we're not going to proceed with the deferred prosecution agreement. And that would have been the end of the story. But on the other hand, it looks as though Justin Trudeau is auditioning for the Michael Jackson commercial where he keeps lighting his hair on fire.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to see the different approaches from either the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party on this, and just to show the main differences between Andrew Scheer and Justin Trudeau on this. The fact that Scheer's whole goal in this was to try and get to the bottom of what the story was actually about, and the fact that Trudeau's trying to cover it up as much as possible, and trying to sue the opposition leader is something that you don't see that happen very often, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you know, we were ready to move on from this story, but lo and behold, here it is again this week. We'll have to see if it rears its head again next week. But you would have thought that was the firing line, but we got one better for the firing line this week.
That's for sure. And our firing line segment, if you're just joining us for the first time, is a segment that we use to highlight a story that's either not been covered by the media fairly, it's been in the media quite a bit recently and hasn't received the right type of coverage, or a story that's just so absurd that it just bears mentioning. And I think this story here that we have for you definitely takes part in that last one there. And this week we're going to take a break from our usual BC coverage to look at something important to a large segment of Canadians, and that's, of course, hockey. Now, as the NHL playoffs get underway, fans from Toronto, Calgary, and Winnipeg are eagerly cheering on their teams as they try to win the elusive Stanley Cup and be the first Canadian team to do so since Montreal in 1993. Now, teams and fans have a tradition of organizing street parties where fans can join other fans in the downtown cores and watch their teams try to win. It ends up being a huge event of merriment. Last year, Winnipeg had a street party during Game 5 of Round 1 that had an estimated 15,000 people, which was actually about the same number of people that were inside the MTS Center watching the Jets take on the Minnesota Wild. Now, the Jets winning in Game 5 led to the first time since 1987 that the Winnipeg had won a playoff series, and fans were jubilant. The Jets were relocated in 1996 to Phoenix, Arizona, and Winnipeg didn't have a team until 2011 when the Atlanta Thrashers franchise was relocated to Winnipeg. For longtime fans who couldn't have the chance to watch the Jets play in person, it was a special moment to still be able to watch them on big screen TVs with their fellow fans in downtown Winnipeg. Now, in that 1987 playoff series, Winnipeg was playing against the Calgary Flames, which had the tradition of having a sea of red, where everyone in the arena would wear red in solidarity with the team colors. Now, in response, Winnipeg started a whiteout, where their fans started wearing white shirts and jerseys to go along with the Jets' primary uniform colors. That was at the time when the Jets' home colors were white, not blue as they are now, but that tradition has stuck to today. Now, this year, the team is keeping up the tradition of the street parties, and due to the success of last year's party, fans wearing white can be seen flocking to downtown Winnipeg to watch their team try to win it all. But some are not happy with the choice of the street party being called a whiteout. In an article from the CBC, highlights a Facebook post from a group called Black Space Winnipeg, and how the cap promoting a whiteout downtown can be triggering to people of color, group says. Now, Black Space Winnipeg is self-described as a non-profit organization that lobbies for safe spaces for Winnipeg's black community. Now, Winnipeg Space Winnipeg founder Alexa Potashnik clarified her remarks in an interview with CBC, who I assume were eager to shed light on this story. She said, quote, "I get the color context 100%, but it's the culture that we're talking about. It's the wording we're critiquing," citing a headline that called for turning Winnipeg's downtown white again as playoffs returned. She said, quote, "It's triggering for some people, for marginalized communities, whether that's black communities, indigenous people of color, folks with disabilities, queer communities, it impacts us all. People have a very narrow definition of what safe is." Potashnik said that her Facebook post hit a nerve. She said she expected some backlash, but not to the extent that she's received, with a lot of angry vitriol and many commenters suggesting that she's hypocritical, suggesting that since her organization has the word black in it. Others called the post ridiculous, stupid, a publicity stunt, a pathetic attempt at outrage, and a joke. At least one commenter said that the post was creating the very thing that Potashnik said she is trying to prevent, which is a rift in society. Someone who identified themselves as a black Jamaican Canadian and proud Winnipegger wrote, quote, "Please, please don't overreach. The struggle is real, but this is not one of them. Black space, I am out." Now, mayhem ensues when these parties take place, according to Potashnik. She said, quote, "It's triggering to see a sea of white when you're walking home from work or school and witnessing aggressive Jets culture as Jets fans flood the streets yelling True North." Now, one commenter took offense to labeling of the White House Street partygoers. He said, quote, "If you zoom in on the crowd, there appears to be many people of color, and they appear to be having a good time. Way to twist a city's love and support for their hockey team to support your own racist propaganda." Now, here's the whole problem with this story. A person that is a founder of an organization with the word black in it is trying to label something that has the word white in it to be racist. Now, rather than ignore the sad attempt to divide people watching hockey along racial lines, the media rushes in to give this person more coverage. She's now had interviews with CBC, CTV, global news radio affiliates, local Winnipeg radio stations, and newspapers across the country. Now, as the post-millennial writes, quote, "Black Space Winnipeg may have unwittingly united all of us, as hockey fans of all creeds will now be joined in their belief that these people have no idea what they're talking about. White House in Winnipeg, blackouts in Pittsburgh, the aforementioned Sea of Red, and traditions of similar nature are common sport practices that have been around for decades. And guess what? They're not racist, they're just fun. Let us have nice things."
You know, this story reminds me of the time we covered the article in which it was suggested that the outdoors was too much of a white space and it was potentially offensive to new immigrants of Canada. And I think this story does one worse on this. And, you know, if you look at any team, whether it be a high school team or a university team or a junior team or even the professional teams in whatever sport it might be, you're always going to see people wearing their jerseys to these events, and the uniforms that they wear are in unison with the color of the team. And, you know, granted, yeah, Winnipeg's colors have shifted towards more blue recently, but I think the tradition involved in it cannot be understated. And, you know, the very fact that term aggressive Jets culture is used and fans yelling True North, well, that True North is semblance of another patriotic element here in Canada, the True North Strong and Free, represented, of course, in our national anthem. And, you know, when you look at that side of it as well, this is just absolutely absurd that this has gained such the media coverage that it has. And I think this potentially rivals the outdoor white space story from last year.
Yeah, I agree. And when I was reading through this story, I was actually remembering that outdoor space story as well, where a woman in Toronto who was actually, I believe she was a graduate of, I think it was social justice and women's rights at the time from the University of Toronto. She was complaining that the outdoor space in Toronto was geared more towards white people, and that white people were the ones that were taking part in the outdoors more, and that the outdoor culture in Toronto shouldn't be so geared towards white people. It's just trying to take something that's very harmless and actually is a positive thing, going outdoors and getting exercise, in this case a street party to cheer on your local hockey team, and take it and try and twist it along racial lines. And this is why we're seeing a lot of these organizations not getting much sympathy from normal Canadians, because they're just trying to divide rather than actually bring us together. And I think that's why this story was, it was very odd that this story was receiving a lot of coverage in the national media, because at this time, it seems like this post itself was something that was really small, but the founder has just got all these interviews with all these different stations, and the story became much bigger than it should have been.
And, you know, that's what we also talked about in the Alberta story as well, is that, you know, you have these stories that start relatively small. They start confined to an area of social media, and then you have the mainstream media covering them. And, you know, it's doing a disservice to the actual issues of the day that are out there that exist. And it's almost as though that the blog world of the mid-2000s has now become the mainstream media. And that's very frightening to us here, because, you know, the core issues are glossed over. And yes, the media is complicit in it, but these groups are practicing something as well called identity politics, which I think takes us nicely into our word of the week.
Yeah, that's true. Our word of the week this week is actually two words, and that is identity politics. We mentioned this earlier on in the show. Now, this is defined as a tendency for people of a particular religion, race, social background, etc., to form exclusive political alliances, moving away from traditional broad-based party politics. And I think we're seeing this a lot in both the Alberta NDP. We've been seeing this in the federal Liberals. We've also been seeing this in a lot of different news sources and organizations online, is that we're seeing a lot of people trying to divide people up on different characteristics that they can't help, such as their race, their social background, how they grew up, where they live, where they choose to live now, even whether they're a male or a female, or on gender lines. And identity politics, we're seeing it so much more these days than we ever used to see it. And it's definitely something that should be highlighted whenever it appears.
Yeah, and it definitely seems that that's somewhere that Justin Trudeau wants to go this fall by putting Andrew Scheer in with Doug Ford and the alt-right and effectively branding them as liars. And it's creating the whole, are you with us, are you against us? And if you're with these groups that we list on the page here, you should probably be with us and against them. And that's not the way to do it. The way, of course, is through ideas and policies that, if for the media, as we say here, it should be based on information and context. That's why we do the show. And we've been largely successful in that. So we do have full show notes available at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the show on any podcast listener that is out there, iTunes, Pocket Cast, Google Play Podcast, you name it, practically anyone. You can figure out how to do that at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. You can also support the show monetarily if you want at westerncontext.ca/support. And we're on Twitter and Facebook, where we post the stories of the week, as well as our supplemental URLs, which you can find us at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week to discuss the results of Alberta's election. Until then, see you soon.
All right, and we'll always make sure to look through all of the stories that the mainstream media talks about and some that they don't talk about, to make sure that we get to actually the bottom of the story and to look at what's actually going on without all of the distraction and identity politics that the mainstream media always likes to talk about. And we'll always make sure that you have the context needed to put yourself on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.